Okay, there we're set to go here, I think. I mentioned in the announcements that talking about the observance of the Feast of Trumpets coming up, Atonement, then the next week after that, the Feast of Tabernacles. You know, we observe these holy days because God gave them to the ancient Israelites. As they left Egypt, he outlined these holy days. We've come to see that it represents the plan of God in many ways, from Passover, which is Christ's sacrifice for our sins, leading into the 7 days of unleavened bread, where we don't eat any food with leavening in it, representing putting sin out of our lives, the leavening representing sin during that period, leading to Pentecost, the anniversary of God freely giving the Holy Spirit to those who have turned to Christ, and then a series of fall holy days, beginning with the Feast of Trumpets, which is reflects the part of God's plan where Christ will return to earth and set up his kingdom, and a lot of the world will not be happy about it, and there will be quite a bit of war going on. And then leading into the Day of Atonement, which represents the putting away of Satan, and then the Feast of Tabernacles, which points towards the millennium and Christ's reign. So we have this series of holy days. We still observe them today. With trumpets coming up very soon here, just a couple of weeks, I thought I might go ahead and talk in the sermon today about some aspects of leading what will lead up to the actual fulfillment of the Feast of Trumpets, Christ's return, and that is the wars that will be going on. You look in the Bible in places like Matthew 24, where it talks about prophecies of what will happen in the future, that Christ basically said there'll come a time when if he did not come back and intervene, then humankind would destroy themselves. And obviously, with the kind of weapons we have today, it's a fact. We could destroy ourselves completely. And that would be the point that Jesus Christ returns. So I want to talk a little bit about that today in terms of war. You know, James said in the book of James, he said, "Where do wars and fights come from among you?" And then he answered that question in the rest of the verse. "Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members?" That's James 4 and verse 1. And so, war is a part, you might say, of human nature, humankind. I thought it might be good to go back and talk about war today and talk about where did war come from? What's the history of war? You ever thought much about that, the history of war, and how war has come to interact and affect God's people down through the ages, going back prior even to the ancient Israelites? So I want to talk about that today. That's where I'm going with the Feast of Trumpets just around the corner. But I'm going to talk about the history of war. Now, I'm going to have some dates up. Most of these dates, some of them go quite far back. The dates, and we look back on the dates of particularly in ancient times, the dates aren't very accurate. Once they started writing things down, it became a little easier to determine dates and so forth. Carbon-14 dating has its weaknesses, so I'm going to be using just showing dates as historians usually post them, but they may not, particularly after about 3,000 or so BC, those dates tend not to be too accurate in many cases. So don't put too much stock in those early dates. Once we get down into the 3000s BC, then those dates start having real meaning. But I show the dates just so we kind of see an order of progression of things. Because war, like everything else, every other human endeavor, has progressed. And so we'll take a look at that. You know, where did it come from? Who started war? Who invented war? Where did it lead the ancient Israelites to? And can raise the question, wasn't there another way? Couldn't God have worked it out without war? You know, so... Let's go look at what the historians say. And it begins, we might begin with, again, going back, this date is probably not very accurate, but going back as they list it, to prior to about 9,000 B.C. We don't have any records or anything much from going back that far. But they have found a few things to indicate that something was happening. Basically, the world population, and actually this is true on up to about 1500 A.D., is that the world population, once it got up to about 250 million, scientists believe that it leveled off there, just from the studies of archaeology, that it leveled off and never rose much above 250 million, 300 million in that range, until pretty much modern times, on up to the around 1500 or so, the curve started going up, and we started having huge population increases. But the world was not a big, highly populated place for most of the past millenniums. And, of course, we understand where population began here in Africa. And a lot of archaeologists say, well, no, it was down here in Africa. And, you know, we understand from the Bible that it was here. But then it spread out into Asia, down into Africa, over into Europe and so forth, and throughout the entire world. But it was a slow process. As not nations in the early days. Here is a nice big map of Asia, Europe, and Africa. And I just show it up here to indicate that what we're going to be talking about is really three areas. The area here centered around Israel, that area, and going around over to Babylon, which became known as the Fertile Crescent, where first civilizations really grew and the culture increased. It was in this area that everything happened first. And then it spread out from there. Another big cultural area was down here in the Egyptian Empire. And the third big area was up here north of the Fertile Crescent, ranging from Eastern Europe all the way over to China. And that area is referred to as the Steppes. And that was a nomadic area. The Huns, so forth, as you hear from history. So, but we're going to talk about mainly these three general areas, but focus in on what was going on in the Middle East, because that's where things started. Now, getting back to what I said, with the population was so spread out, there weren't nations originally. There were groups of peoples, large families, tribes, that sort of thing at first. And all the archaeological evidence indicates that there were maybe a few villages here and there, but mostly there were wandering tribes that lived in certain areas, and that these early humans, after Adam and Eve were cast out of the Garden of Eden, that there was a lot of scavenging going on as before they really learned how to take care of themselves. You know, God had replenished the earth, and there was lots of things there, but they had to learn how to take care of that. And so the indications are from archaeological digs that they began as scavengers, basically, and in very small tribes. And then at that time, there's no indication of wars. And there wasn't much motivation. Historians conclude that there was plenty of land. Small number of people, plenty of land. If you didn't have enough land, just moved a little further one way or the other, south, north, west, or east. And there's plenty of land. And so land wasn't an issue. And people had few possessions. You know, the main thing was trying to live, to survive at that time. And so there wasn't much motivation for war. And you saw nothing in the archaeological record indicates that there was much war or fighting going on. which is kind of interesting. They did identify archaeologically the first spear, which was wood with a stone point. But the indications are it wasn't used for war. Cave art, going back to that time, showed hunting with spears. It was primarily a hunting society, not a war society, for example. Here's one example of cave art. But there's not much indication that people fought a lot back in those days, more like they were trying to survive. And they also had the first evidence of a spear-throwing device. And it looks, here's a drawing that shows what it looked like. It's basically a stick with a notch on the end that you could put the one end of the spear in and then throw it, and basically it increased your lever arm. Talking about engineering here, increased your lever arm, gave you a larger moment, and you could put more velocity around behind it. Kind of like twirling a ball on a string. The longer that string is, the faster it's going to go as you twirl it. Same kind of principle here. But again, the indications are all this was used for hunting. Now, again, the archaeologists put a date of around 9,000 B.C. on what they called the bow revolution. The bow and arrow was discovered, or at least the first indications of the bow and arrow were found dating back about this far. It was a straight bow, when the strings were either hemp or human hair, sinew. So very, very crude, you might say. But again, all the evidence in this case, it was used for hunting. No indications, no cave art showing war, no indications of war weapons and that sort of thing. Just hunting. And then around, further on, another 1,000 years, the agriculture revolution began. And I mentioned that we have these three core regions. And this is a blow-up of that map I showed you earlier. But again, this area from down in the border of Egypt going up into Syria towards Turkey, and then coming back down in this side here, the Fertile Crescent. Yeah, and then up in this area, this is the steppes, where the steppes people were, and then, of course, down in this area, the Egyptians. Those are the core areas where civilization began and spread out to. So, the Middle East, Fertile Crescent, that's probably what everybody knows the most about. Most about it from biblical history, most about it from what you learned in school. Talk a lot about the Fertile Crescent as being kind of the birthplace of culture, and just about everything happened in the Fertile Crescent area of the Middle East, and then spread to other places. But then the steppes from Eastern Europe to China, don't know as much about those. For one thing, they were nomadic people, so they moved around a lot. They didn't build cities. They didn't leave much. They didn't leave writing. Writing started pretty early in the Middle East, but was in Egypt, but not so much. So we don't know a lot about the people of the steppes region. But we do know this, at least they think they know this, that they were the first to domesticate the horse. And as a nomadic people, that's what they did. They domesticated them. At first, they were too small to ride, and they used them to pull carts, or they called them perhaps chariots, but they were four-wheeled and pretty heavy, not really a war machine. But they were the first to domesticate horses, and then eventually they bred larger ones that they could ride and pull the more modern chariots. And then, of course, Egypt, we know a lot about the Egyptian culture, all the dynasties and so forth. It goes back almost as far as the Middle East does. All right, so what happened during the agricultural revolution? Historians and archaeologists speculate that it probably developed because that Middle Eastern area started getting larger populations. and running out of land, just to scavenge, you know, just to kind of go get things, hunt and that sort of thing. And so they developed agriculture, and so land became more important. You know, with land more valuable, now the stakes of war meant more because that land was valuable because you farmed it. And so evidence of war began to show up and increase from this time forward. Now, again, it was not much evidence of war, but you did see some evidence that tribes did go to war from time to time once the agricultural revolution got going. For example, the first evidence of a fortified wall was in Jericho, one of the oldest towns, you might say, or village. But they found evidence of a fortified wall in Jericho. Here's some of the excavations around Jericho. Give you some idea of, didn't mean to hit that, which what some of those excavations look like. But they've traced Jericho back to one of the oldest villages and that had any kind of fortified wall. Now, not a lot changed for a while. And let's jump up to 4000 B.C. Now, from this point on, dates begin to get a little more accurate for what they have more meaning. But as I mentioned in the steppes, the horses that were domesticated, they were too small to ride. They pulled four-wheel chariots that were bulky. And over time, they bred larger horses for riding. And with these larger horses, they begin to develop their skills with riding horses using the spear and riding horses and shooting bow and arrow. So they begin to develop those skills, and they became somewhat of a more warlike culture than the Middle East and Egypt, at least at that time. Now, something happened a few hundred years later, the Bronze Revolution. Now, the Bronze Revolution began to have an impact on war. Bronze is made from copper and tin. The problem with bronze is that, first of all, at that time, the materials were rare. It's a little hard to get. But more important than that, the material was too soft and weak to make swords with. And so, basically, once the people at that time developed skills with bronze, they begin to use them as tips for arrows, tips for the end of wooden spears, as well as short daggers. But they couldn't. They were too weak to try to make a normal length sword. They would just start sword fighting. They would break. And so here's an example of some daggers that have been discovered in some archaeological remains. But these were short and not that effective, but using as tips on arrows and spears, that was effective. So that helped a lot. Now, in this period from 4000 to about 2200 BC, Mesopotamia developed. It was a sophisticated culture that developed here first. Now, this is where you might say human history really began in terms of culture development and that sort of thing. By 3500 B.C., the leading city in Mesopotamia was the city of Uruk, which had a population of 50 to 60,000. Now, this was at a time when in most of the world, if you had a population of 1,000 in a locality, that was a lot. But here in Mesopotamia, the population growth and the building of cities, and this was the leading city of many, and it was during this time of around 3500 B.C. that we began to see the first fortified cities began to appear. So by this time, you might say it looks like there was more concerned about war than it had been up to that period of time. The first fortified cities appeared. Around 3300 B.C., Ophel was occupied. Ophel is the lower part of Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. In other words, that's the beginnings of a settlement in Jerusalem occurred around 3300 B.C., just to get kind of a time frame going on here. So not much was going on down in the Israel side of the Fertile Crescent. All the culture and growth, and population growth, war machine growth, was all taking place on the other side of the Fertile Crescent in Mesopotamia. Now, around 3000 B.C., written records in both Egypt and Mesopotamia began to appear, but they reflected an unmilitary societies. They didn't see records about wars and conquering and feasts or anything like that. It was more about trade, contracts, these sorts of things. There was just very little indication that war was a big part of culture at that time. You know, so we're down to around 3000 B.C. We're not seeing much in the way of war. It's almost like kind of a police force as opposed to armies that might have existed at that time. Now, around 2900 to 2800, we do see growing indications of war. They built 40-foot high walls around Uruk, and this also occurred among other cities in that area. So they built these high walls, obviously in anticipation of some of the attacks that might come. That area of Mesopotamia, basically a country arose in that area called Sumer, S-U-M-E-R. And around the same time, around 3000 B.C., some of the earliest tablets were found in Sumer. And they had no mention of walls, no mentions of wars, no mention of weapons and anything like that. But soon afterwards, they started building walls. And by 27 B.C., more evidence of increasing warfare, more weapons were found in the archaeological ruins at those levels, and we begin to see some things were happening. Now, around 2550 B.C. was the first written evidence of war in the Middle East. They found some tablets that actually began talking about war. 50 years later, the first written record of a battle has been found. Again, that was in Sumer. And so so gradually, mankind was drifting more and more towards settling problems with war. But the war instruments were very crude at that time. Then we jump down to around 2200 B.C., the Chariot Revolution. And the Chariot Revolution, basically what happened here, along with the Chariot Revolution, it became an era of tremendous conflict all through the Middle East and in surrounding areas of Egypt and the steppes. Now, and likely the chariot itself hastened that on. The chariots had spoke wheels, were lighter, pulled by horses. They typically carried a driver and a bowman. And so they were pretty effective weapons of war. And what also was going on at this time is that very powerful monarchs began to arise with centralized governments, large palace complexes, bureaucracies. In other words, we began to see nations form, and these nations were basically ruled by monarchs. And with that came the development of armies. Now, at around 2000 B.C., long about the time of the Chariot Revolution, the composite bow was introduced to the Middle East, or in the Middle East. And the composite bow was just a straight thing. You bent it and tied a string on it. The composite bow consisted of layers of wood that were glued together, and you could shape this bow. So even when the string is not taut, the bow maintained a shape. They took off half of a horn and put that at the center for the handle. And these composite bows, first of all, are much stronger. and so they were more accurate. And so these composite bows changed warfare again. States all through the Middle East, Egypt, became highly militarized during this time. Now, we see the first indications of strategies of war with armies. Things like blockades, assault strategies were developed. And we see that cities came under siege. And those walls began to serve a real purpose that were built around cities at that time. So this is right around 2000 B.C. All right, so what we have now at this point, we have the Fertile Crescent, you know, this nice loop. What's across the Fertile Crescent was all desert. That's why it was in a crescent shape. We have the Fertile Crescent with the eastern side of that crescent, Sumer, Mesopotamia, that area there, was where civilization was growing, had grown the fastest, had progressed the most, and gradually spread to the other side of the Fertile Crescent, to the north of the steppes, to the south to Egypt. So we're in that position where there's a lot of wars going on. States, not just states, but now there were city-states. And they were constantly fighting. And at this point, we come to Abraham. Now, we believe that Abraham lived in the vicinity of around 2000 B.C. And Abraham lived in Sumer. In Genesis chapters 11 through 13, we won't turn to those, but in those three chapters, we see that Abraham was living in the city of Ur. Now, the city of Ur was not very far from the leading city in Sumer, which we talked about, Uruk. So they were fairly close together. I don't know, less than 50 miles or so apart. So Abraham was living in the middle of the most highly developed culture of that time, and one of the wealthiest nations at that time, and in a period of time that war was breaking out all over. And so Abraham left for Canaan. There was a famine, so he went down to Egypt for a while. Then he finally settled between Bethel and Ai. Here's a map that kind of shows what we're talking about here. There's Ur way down there. This is all desert across here. So he went up through Babylon, more than likely, parallel to the Euphrates River. Haran, where some of his family ended up settling. Then he came on down to Canaan. Then over to Egypt, probably in the area of Goshen, then back up and settled up here in the vicinity of Bethel, in that area. So that's what he did. Now, that raises some questions. Why did God call him out at that time and send him there? Could it be because of what was God foresaw was going to be happening over in the eastern side of the Fertile Crescent? Did he see the things were going to happen? There's a lot of fighting, a lot of wars, major battles, armies, monarchs, building of chariots, the new invention, the bow, the new bow, composite bow. All this kind of thing, raising large armies, all that was going on over there. It was a little slower developing over in the western side of the Fertile Crescent. So it makes you wonder if maybe God said, well, I need to get Abraham out of there and get him over to an area that wasn't quite as warlike, although it wasn't long before it would spread there. If we look at Genesis 14 and verse 14, there's an incident that occurred. And I just want to mention it briefly here in Genesis 14, verse 14. Now, when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, that was Lot, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his own house and went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah. which is north of Damascus. And so the indications of this in other scriptures is, first of all, Abraham was very wealthy. He had over 300 servants. Apparently they were well trained. And it's one interesting thing, back in that time, in Sumer and other nations in the Fertile Crescent area, it was the wealthy that did the fighting. Only those that were of, you might say, that class, the wealth class, could afford the chariots, the armor, the spears, the bows, and so they did the fighting. And so it's kind of interesting. And so you wonder if Abraham did not learn those skills while he was in Sumer. But in either case, so here, let me flip back here to that map again. So, you know, here he is. He's down here in this vicinity. This group is taken, and he follows them as far as the Dan. That's a pretty good little trip there. That wasn't just a overnight hike. And eventually north of Damascus, up into this area here. And we're way up into Syria when we get up into the Damascus area. And so they had to have ways to travel, more than likely horses, arms, and so forth. But it raises another issue here, too, and that is 318 men? That's your army? Now, one of two things could be construed here. One thing is that they were still very small tribal areas over here in the land of Canaan. And 300 was considered a pretty good sized army for that time in that area. You know, that's one assumption. The other assumption, I think this is the likely one, is that God intervened. And we can get a hint of that if we go over to Genesis 14, verses 19 through 20. And he, Melchizedek, blessed him, referring to Abraham, after he caught him, came back, and they came back with a lot of bounty and so forth. Abraham didn't take any of that. He gave some to his men and gave the rest to Melchizedek. And Melchizedek blessed him. Blessed be the Abram, the God God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And then Abraham gave a tithe of all. So here we see that the enemy was delivered into Abraham's hand. Now, this is one of the first examples where God begins to intervene in the affairs of man as he's called them out, in terms of war at least. God intervened. Here was a small war that went on, and God intervened, delivered the enemy into Abraham's hand, and so this was the beginning of a pattern. God's people. Sometimes armies were raised, but God controlled the battles. You know, God's hand was in it, for either positive or negative, depending on the times, as we'll see here. All right, so there's Abraham in the middle of all this going on. Major, tremendous battles over in the east of the Fertile Crescent. Smaller city-states, more than anything else, tribes on the western side, the Canaan area of the Fertile Crescent. But then, around 1500, came the sword revolution. The sword revolution. Now, the sword revolution, first that were the Hittites. The Hittites were on up north of Syria, on up towards the steppes. Matter of fact, Hittites were probably originally steppe people that migrated south. But the Hittites that first used iron. But it wasn't used too much for the next few hundred years because of several reasons. First, it was more difficult to produce than bronze. And the problem was you needed high heat. You needed temperatures 1,500 to 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit to work with iron. And then in addition to that, it required skilled blacksmiths to know how to do that. And so it took a while for them to figure all this out and produce iron swords. But gradually iron did replace bronze. And along about this time, something called the Nautu sword was invented. And it seems that up until this time, there was the blade and the handle, and they were joined mechanically. But the Na sword had a blade and then like a tongue sticking out from the hilt of the sword, but it was all one continuous piece. Then, of course, they wrapped it up and made a handle out of that. But when they had a sword and a handle of one continuous piece, then that really was a big step forward. The sword itself was a big step forward because now you could use something long, and that meant close order combat. And the fact that it had a handle that wouldn't snap off was even better. And so this was a big step forward with this Nautu sword was invented. And, you know, before that, the wars of people on chariots, they were throwing spears at each other, shooting bow and arrows at each other. Apparently there wasn't a lot of hand-to-hand combat back then. It was more distance. But this basically kind of fighting, it came up close and personal once the iron sword became widely used. Now let's drop down to around 1400 B.C. and talk about the Exodus and the invasion of Canaan. As you know, it was over about a 400-year period that the ancient Israelites were in Egypt. They became slaves. God intervened in many miraculous ways during the Exodus to bring the children of Israel out. We'll pick up here, though, at the very end of the Exodus period there, when Pharaoh changed his mind. He finally gave up after all the plagues. Basically, Egypt had been destroyed by God. Wasn't the Israelites that did it. It was God. But there was this utter destruction in the land. But even at that point, Pharaoh said, I'm going after him. I'm not letting him get away with this. And the Bible indicates that he took 600 chariots after the Israelites. So he still had weapons of war. 600 chariots, that's a lot of weapons. That's still a decent-sized army. And, of course, I'm sure he had more than just the chariots, too. But you know what happened to that? They're down somewhere, went down somewhere in the bottom of the Red Sea there. All right, so the Israelites get out of Egypt. They're marching across towards Canaan. They come to Mount Sinai. God is now working with them, and he says, here's the deal. And we see the deal first explained in Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6, at the foot of Mount Sinai, Exodus 20, when they received the Ten Commandments. But he says, now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. He was talking to Moses, said, this is what you want to tell the children of Israel. So he's saying, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to make you a very special people, a chosen people, special people, priest. But there was a condition to it. And, of course, in giving the Ten Commandments and then explaining the other laws associated with the Ten Commandments, said, here are the conditions. You have to obey. You have to follow the commandments and the laws. And he spelled them all out in detail. And then about Exodus 25 or so, after he spelled out all the details, he said, all right, now you've heard the fine print. Do you still agree? And they said, we do. And thus the old covenant was ratified. And so God began working with the children of Israel as they came out of Egypt. Now we go back just slightly to Exodus 17, verses 11 through 13. As they were heading towards Mount Sinai, they ran into the army of Amalek. small nation there on the border between Canaan and Egypt in that area. And so there was a battle. And so it was when Moses held up his hand. Moses was positioned up on a hilltop. The battle was taking place down below. And when he raised up his hands, Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hand became heavy, so they took up stone, put it under him. He sat on it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side, one on the other side. And his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. So the Israelites were armed by this time, probably with leftover Egyptian weapons. But they were armed. They went into battle, and they defeated Amalek at this time. And so it's one of the first battles that are recorded after the Israelites left Egypt. And it was in self-defense. It was the Amalekites that attacked them. But why did God go through that? Why not just say, I'm with you, go ahead and deliver? He delivered them. Why this business with the holding up the hands? Moses got tired. You ever tried holding up your hands for a long time? You know, you get tired. And he dropped his hands. All of a sudden, you can see the battle waging. And all of a sudden, the tide of war changed. And he holds his hand up, then the tide of war changed the other way. Why? Why make such a big show? Couldn't he just... Moses said, look, God's going to be with you. Go out there and defeat him. Now, there's a message there. God wanted the Israelites to understand what it meant for him to intervene. Now, they had the same skill when he had his hands up, when he had his hands down. The Amalekites had the same skill when he had his hands up or down. You know, suddenly things didn't change skill-wise between the combatants. So the only thing that was happening was either God was intervening or he was not. That was making the difference. You think the guys that were down there doing the fighting didn't realize that? And thinking, well, he's got his hands down and we're losing. Now his hands back up and we're winning. I like this deal. Keep those hands up. But see, there was a message being delivered to those ancient Israelites. And it was a simple message. As long, you know, God told Moses, keep your hands up. As long as Moses obeyed, they won. As soon as Moses disobeyed, you could say, they started losing. And it was a very simple, dramatic lesson that they could all see. Do what God says, and he will deliver you. And so this was the beginning of the, not so much the beginning, because they had learned things on their trip out of Egypt, all the plagues, how some of the plagues didn't affect them. They were protected. And as they went on out, God kept intervening and so forth. And they seen a lot of miracles. But here, they were getting a different, you might say a different message. You know, you do what I say, and you're going to be protected. Now, they get over to Canaan. Go in. They send out the spies. They send out the spies. Spies come back. I didn't know this was what it was going to be. They got some soldiers over there in Canaan. And they're big. And they're strong. And they look mean. I don't think we should go. 10 of the 12 spies. This is not the deal. How are we going to go in and defeat those armies? And only Joshua and Caleb said, yeah, let's go in. God's behind us. They got it. The rest of them didn't. They understood. They got the picture. And so the result was, okay, you don't want to go in? You won't go in. And so he said, you're going to wander 40 years in the wilderness until all this generation is dead, and then a new generation will go in. And then they rethought it. Wait a minute, 40 years in the wilderness? Whoa, that's a long time. I mean, I'd live 40 years. And so they changed their minds. So they went up to Moses and said, okay, we decided to go in. Moses said, not so fast. And that's where we're picking up here in verse 42. of Numbers 14:42. Moses says, "Do not go up, lest you be defeated by your enemies, for the Lord is not among you. For the Amalekites, the Canaanites, are there before you, and you shall fall by the sword, because you have turned away from the Lord, and the Lord will not be with you." But they presumed to go up to the mountaintop. After all, they'd been winning battles, right? They'd been winning battles. So they went on up to the mountaintop. "Nevertheless, neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moses departed from the camp. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who dwelt in that mountain came down, attacked them, and drove them back as far as Hormah." You know, so here we see the situation. You know, God is teaching them a lesson. They didn't want to listen. And they said, "Oh, if it's 40 years in the wilderness, let's go on in. We'll take our chances. We'll either die in the wilderness or we'll die at the end of the hands of the Canaan." That was kind of the way they looked at it, probably. But it was too late then. And so they all ended up bones there in the wilderness somewhere. And a new generation came in. And so the invasion of Canaan began. Now, by this time, Canaan and that whole section of the Fertile Crescent had changed a lot from Abraham's time. They basically, a lot of city-states had grown up. Lots of armed forces. And it was more in a warlike mentality that Mesopotamia was, Sumer was, over on the eastern part of the Fertile Crescent was 400 years earlier. So now, you might say that the area of Israel had caught up with Mesopotamia. And so they show up across the Jordan at Jericho there. What happens? They didn't have to lift a finger. Well, they did. They had to blow some trumpets. But they didn't fight. Now, what an example of God fighting the battles. The destruction of Jericho, a very heavily armed, fortified city. And so it was destroyed. You know the story there. Now you'd think, you know, so now we're seeing the Israelites are getting in a war mode, because to take the land of Canaan was a full-scale war. Not just some little thing. It was a full-scale war. And so after Jericho, then the next battle was Ai. And they didn't get it. Again, they didn't get it, because what happened, you know, God said, when you take Jericho, don't take any accursed things. Yeah, don't take the gold, the silver, and all the kind of things that were cursed, used for idol worship and that sort of thing, more than likely. He said, don't do that. And some did. And so they went to Ai, and in Joshua 7, verse 4, said, they spied it out and said, that's a small place. And so about 300 men went up there from the people, but they fled before the men of Ai. They only sent 3,000 soldiers over there because it was such a small place. And they were routed. Joshua went up, what's going on here? God said, there's some disobedience in the crowd. And they went through a series of lots, finally found out who was the ones that were had done that, and got that issue settled. Those people were stoned. They didn't mess around in those days. You do things bad, you get stoned. You know, capital punishment was alive and well in those days. And so then in chapter 8 of Joshua, chapter 8, verse 3, so Joshua rose and all the people of war to go up against Ai, and Joshua chose 30,000 mighty men of valor and sent them away by night. And so, so they went on out, and so they went out in Joshua 11:4. They went out and all their armies. I skipped ahead a minute here. Let me go back a second here, getting ahead of myself. They went out with the 30,000. They conquered Ai, no problem. God was with them again. But now they went on into Canaan, an all-out war. with the city-states there. In Joshua 11:4, so they went out, they and all their army. Now, this is talking about armies of Canaan now. All the kingdoms in the land of Canaan got together and said, we got to join together and stop the Israelites. And so they went out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore, in multitude with very many horses and chariots. So we see they had become very much war-minded. They had chariots, they had horses, obviously they had large armies, described here as the sand and the seashore. So basically what's happened, the entire area of Canaan joined together to resist the Israelites after these initial victories that happened, places like Jericho, Ai, some of the others. Now it was full-scale, all-out war. And that's what the book of Joshua is all about. It's describing everything that went on to capture Canaan. It took years before it was finished. And so it was a massive war, but God delivered them victory in many battles. For example, the Ammonites and Bashans prior to the crossing of the Jordan, even. And we see this a lot. God delivered them. I mean, they fought the battles, but God delivered them. But then in others, you know, God completely fought the battles. Like at Gibeon against the five Amorite kings, which is found in Joshua 10:10. Joshua 10:10, so the Lord routed them before Israel, killed them with a great slaughter at Gibeon. And so here's that God did it. So sometimes God just intervened, like he did at Jericho, different times down through the history of the Israelites. All of a sudden, they all run away or they all just fall dead. But other times, God delivers them in the sense that they go fight and they get victory, but it's God that's turning the tide and that sort of thing. And so this was all out. This was major warfare going on at that time, and it lasted for years. Unfortunately, the Israelites did not wipe out all of those people. And, you know, some people say, boy, why was God so cruel to kill them all? And it's because they were so cruel. You know, Canaan was known in their religious beliefs for child sacrifice. You know, burning up their kids. That was the kind of people they were dealing with. God said, enough of that. Wipe them out. Unfortunately, the Israelites didn't, and they came back to haunt them over and over again, because they would rise up and get power and then attack, and then especially when the Israelites were disobedient, then they'd get obedient again and so forth. But you know, we're talking about now real war. Then we move into the period of the judges, and this is where it was all happening, this continuing cycle. The Israelites would obey. They would have victory after victory. But then they would drift into a stage of disobedience, and they'd be conquered. And they'd be subdued by the Philistines, by these different armies. They'd be subdued, and then victory. They'd change, they'd repent, they'd turn to God, then they would be freed, God would deliver them, and it was up and down, over and over again. Judges 4 and verse 13, Deborah and Barak defeated Sisera. So Sisera gathered together all of his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the people who were with him. So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him, and the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword. So here, Israelites only had 10,000 men. Sisera had this huge army that included 900 chariots. You know, but God delivered them. You know, and that's the way God worked. He delivered. And so, you know, then they'd get disobedient again. And they'd be conquered. You know, Gibeon versus the Midianites, found in Judges 6 and 7. You know what happened there with Gideon. Gideon went out with 32,000 men and said, no, God said, nope, forget that. 300 will do it. And he weeded it down to 300. Obviously, God was going to do the real fighting here and not that 300. But that's where God worked. He was there. He was interacting. Sometimes they did the fighting. Sometimes he just delivered himself. Just forget it. Get send 300 men out there and I'll take care of the rest. But the conditions were obedience to God. As long as the Israelites were paying attention to God, they were winning. They were winning the wars. There were wars. There were enemies. They were surrounded by enemies. But they were winning the wars. We got other, Samson's a good example. I don't know the stories about Samson. Now, interesting enough, along about this time, historians describe the period from 1200 to 900 B.C. They call it the catastrophe. The catastrophe. And what they mean by the catastrophe was that many of the Middle Eastern kingdoms vanished. Gone. What happened? All these nation states, city states, and so forth, they disappeared, at least in archaeological history. Much of the writing disappeared. Wasn't a lot, and so they didn't have any writing. But all of a sudden, it seems like there was a void here in this period between 1200 and 900. Egypt, there are some records down in Egypt that spoke of an invasion by sea peoples. So some of that was coming from perhaps Greeks and Phoenicians and people from the sea moving on the coastal towns. But what happened? They don't know. That's why they call it the catastrophe. Because so many of these kingdoms disappeared in this time period. Now, interestingly enough, what else happened around 1000 B.C.? David happened. That's nothing. A lot of historians don't believe there was a David. We don't have any evidence of David. There's no writing. There's nothing. We don't have any evidence of David. We can't find any record of David. They finally did find some reference to David. Finally found a little reference to David. But apparently at that time, nobody was writing down things much. But they were sure conquering and setting up an empire. And this shows the extent of David's empire. You know, you can see down to Egypt, all the way up to Turkey, all the way up there. That was the extent. Went up to the Euphrates River, the Bible says. David's empire happened during the catastrophe. So it may have been a catastrophe for a lot of those heathens, but it wasn't a catastrophe for God's people. It was just the opposite. David created that empire. It flourished in peace during Solomon's reign. Look at 2 Samuel 8, verses 11 and 12. Now, King David also dedicated these to the Lord, along with the silver and the gold that he had dedicated from all the nations which he had subdued, from Syria, Moab, people of Ammon, from the Philistines, from Amalek, from the spoils of Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah. That's on up north towards Turkey. He just did the whole area. And took all their gold and silver. And there was the Davidic Empire that occurred. So that's what was going on. David built a war machine, but the important thing is he had God behind him. And he built an empire. Left it to Solomon. 960 B.C. That's probably a pretty good date there. Solomon builds the first temple. But then Solomon, he turned away from God. And after Solomon, steady decline. Over and over and over. 933 B.C., the kingdom splits. Northern 10 tribes, Judah in the south, two different kingdoms. 913 B.C., a major battle between Israel and Judah. Now notice how, as we come along in history here, we're talking about, yeah, there were these 300 men like Abraham going up, small armies, tribes, city-states, that sort of thing, is gradually built up, the weapons increased, the armies became larger, the fortifications, so everything just grew, war. And now we come into, well into the decline of the nations of Israel and Judah, and a major battle occurred between the two. Abijah set the battle order with an army of valiant warriors, 400,000 choice men. Jeroboam also drew up in battle formation against him with 800,000 choice men, mighty men of valor. Look at the magnitude of these armies in the course from Abraham, 1,000 years earlier or so, to then. Huge, massive arms race had built up. Now, you read through the full description there, and you see that what Jeroboam did, he set up an ambush, led the Judah into the ambush, and suddenly Judah found themselves with Israelites on either side of them. But this, you know what this was? It was basically a civil war. Now, these were kinfolks, you might say. 2 Samuel 13, 15 through 17. Then the men of Judah gave a shout, and as the men of Judah shouted, it happened that God struck Jeroboam and all Israel before Abijah and Judah. And the children of Israel fled before Judah, and God delivered them into their hand. Then Abijah and his people struck them with great slaughter. So 500,000 choice men of Israel died. 500,000. Think about that. You know, we view ourselves, Britain, America, as ancestors to those ancient Israelites. You know, we view that we have come down from them, basically. So with that understanding, the biggest slaughter of Israelites, peoples, perhaps between then and the 1860s, the American Civil War, again, fighting among ourselves, you know how many were slaughtered in the Civil War, both sides combined? 500,000. 500,000. That's all the way back to the kingdom, Judah and Israel, fighting each other. 500,000 destroyed. Now, God intervened to protect Judah because Israel had already gone too far. God had written off those northern 10 tribes. And then, about that time, the Assyrian Empire rises. The Assyrians were part steppe people that migrated south, took over parts of the very northern part of Mesopotamia. And what happened? They had standing armies. They combined the steppe open warfare with chariots and horsemen, with the Middle East sword and shield siege armies. They combined everything. They were a powerful empire. They used military intelligence. They used propaganda to terrify. Everybody was scared of the Assyrians, and they took advantage of that. They conquered. Now, here's one thing they did. They conquered a state, and it became a province of Assyria. And they had local rulership. And then they conquered. So that way, they were able to kind of let the locals take care of the local stuff, and they just took care of the big stuff. And that pattern followed with the other great empires that arose. Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar, same thing. The Persians, the Medes, same thing. The Romans, the same thing. They all followed that pattern of the Assyrian Empire. Their horsemen fired arrows from horseback. Here's a picture of that type of thing. depicted from back in that era. Now, what they did in 9/11, they took Upper Mesopotamia. 875, they took the North Aramean states, and that was in Asa's reign of Judah. So they're up in the north. You might say the hump of the Fertile Crescent, that's where they are. They're up in that area taking things. Then 853, they took Syria during Jehoshaphat's reign. 850, they took Babylon down on the other side of the Fertile Crescent during Jehoram's reign. In 722, northern Israel failed, collapsed. All the people were carted off, assembled into other cultures somewhere else. We believe they eventually migrated to Europe, Britain, United States. But they were gone. They called the Lost Ten Tribes because of that reason. So Israel was gone as a nation, and the people were hauled away. In 722. But that left Judah. So in 700 B.C., in Judah, Hezekiah barely survives the Assyrian attacks. Almost loses then. But about that time, the Babylonian Empire rises. 633 B.C., we see the beginning of the Babylonian Empire. They rebelled against Assyria. They were under the rule of the Assyrians. They rebelled in 633. Babylon was over there on the other side of the Fertile Crescent, the eastern side, kind of down towards the southern part of the crescent. They started marching up the crescent, up the crescent, over the hill, eventually coming down to Jerusalem, fighting Assyrians every inch of the way. So they gradually basically conquered Syria from east to west. 606 B.C., there was this decisive battle of Carchemish, and that was the end of the Assyrian Empire. They were destroyed at that battle. Nebuchadnezzar didn't stop. He moved on down between 605 and 586. Every few years, he'd send a wave of his armies to Jerusalem, siege it. Jerusalem would pay them off. They would go away. They'd come back. Attack again a few years later because Judah would stop paying them. Five different waves over a period of roughly 20 years until finally Jerusalem fell, and that was the end of the ancient Israelites. They were gone. Now notice what happened here. We're talking about a 3,500 year period for these tools of war to advance from wooden spear, the stone thing, to the kind of massive armies and weapons and attacks and so forth. And really, if you look at it, you can go, it's about 2,700 years war really became something, from... As you come on down, there were little things, but wars didn't really take a serious meaning until around 2700 B.C., somewhere along in there, 2700 B.C. It was relatively peaceful states. It went from relatively peaceful states to all-out mass destruction, basically, in about 2700 years. And that's about the time period between the fall of Jerusalem and the beginnings of real war was about 2,700 years. And the thing is, where are we right now? Well, think about it. They went from wooden spears and stone weapons to bow and arrow, to bronze-tipped spears and arrows along with bronze daggers, to foot soldiers with shields, spears, and bows, to chariots with bowmen and drivers, to iron swords, shields, and body armor, to horsemen with spears and bows, to siege machines, to total destructive warfare. 2,700 years, roughly, that's what happened. That's how far, you might say, the world deteriorated into the heart of war. Now, so Israel was gone, around 500 B.C. So where are we now? From that time. Not quite another 2,700 years, are we? getting on up there towards another 2,700 years. Now, we observe the Feast of Trumpets, and that's when Christ is going to return and put an end to wars for good. And so what I want to do in my sermon on the Feast of Trumpets, I'm going to talk about from the fall of Jerusalem to Christ's return and what has happened to the state of war during that time.